Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Expecto Patronum!
Good. You.
That's not true.
That's impossible.
You're a wizard, Harry.
It's time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Dave Tree.
That's not true.
That's impossible.
You're listening to Making Tracks. I'm your host, Mark Newbold, and today we have a special episode. It's a bit different for us. This is a Harry Potter-focused episode from Comic-Con at Film New Forest. I had the good fortune to sit down with Chris Rankin, who played Percy Weasley, and James Payton, who was Frank Longbottom, that's Neville's dad, in the Harry Potter series. We got to talk about Potter, we got to talk about film in general. So it's a bit different for us for an episode, but here's a little bit of a detour into some different territory. It's myself, Chris and James at Comic-Con at Film New Forest.
I'm going to start off. Chris, I'll stop.
Hello.
You because you're sitting right next to me.
Yes. So I'm sat on one chair.
I'm not going to ask you about your Potter-related film experiences.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you when you very first was aware of the books, of the character, of that world, what was your first experience when you first came across it, and what did you think of it?
My first experience was actually not very far from here. When I was younger, we used to go on holiday to the Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
So as we pulled into Livington to get on the ferry to the Isle of Wight, my mum, who was is an English teacher, still teaching, but she used to teach at the high school that I went to. Yeah. And the first book came out in 1990, somebody wants to tell me, six, seven, something like that. whose car alarm's that?
Hopefully not mine.
Yeah, when the first book came, so my mum was an English teacher at the school. The school librarian used to give her a pile of new, interesting books that everyone was talking about for her to take on summer holidays, basically palm off on me, and go, read these. If they're any good, we'll get a stock of them for the school library.
Yeah.
So she handed me Philosopher's Stone and Chamber of Secrets.
Okay.
I think Chamber of Secrets had just come out just before that summer holiday.
Yeah.
And went, read these. People are talking about them. So I sat in a tent on the Isle of Wight and read both of them in about a day and a half.
Wow.
And went, oh my God, these are amazing. And I really enjoyed them. And yeah, from that moment was...
It was on your radar.
I was a Harry Potter fan. I would be waiting for the new book to come out. I had the audiobooks that Stephen Fry read on cassette.
Yeah.
you can remember those? Nothing. Yeah, loved it. Absolutely loved it. Was queuing outside Waterstones at midnight for book, you know, like proper.
Yeah, Potterhead.
Yeah, as everybody was.
Absolutely.
I was 13, 14, yeah, so.
Same question.
I'm quite old. so I must have been in my early 20s I'm quite old. when it first came out, so it's sort of. I had a flatmate who started reading them. He said, oh, you should read these. Oh, they're kids' books, aren't they? Yeah, yeah, but there's a bit more to it than that. I was like, okay, cool. So I read one, and same thing, you just kind of suddenly race through it.
Yeah.
Mm. You just race through them. And then, you know, when the new ones come out, then you go through it again. And I was aware of it, and then, you know, I remember the first movie coming out in 2001, was it?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, God, every actor in the UK is going to be in one of these movies. And then, in 2006, I got a call from David Yates' office saying, David wants to see you for Frank Longbottom in Harry Potter. And I was like, busy. I was doing a movie at the time. We were in King's Lynn.
Yeah.
So I was like, sorry, I'm busy. And they said, oh, okay. You did say it was Harry Potter, right? And I was like, yeah, but I've got this thing. And the next day they phoned back and said, don't you understand? David wants to see you and you for this.
Very specifically,
yeah. And I said, okay. So I spoke to the production I was on and they said, look, just go, it's fine. And we were doing night shoots. So we did a night shoot. Then the following day, I travelled down from King's Lynn to Leavesden and had my screen test with Lisa, who played Alice, and a bunch of other, all of the Phoenix sorts.
Yeah.
They were very happy. It was all very good. It was all a go. And then I travelled back up to Grimsby, where the unit had moved to do another night shoot.
Grimsby.
Yeah. Well named. And it's really only the last kind of couple of hours that you start seeing stuff, having been awake for so long. And yeah, then, you know, and then I did the job, and I had costume fittings and all that sort of thing. But it didn't, you know, the actual shoot itself was a day for me.
Yeah.
So it was a job, and you know, I was like, oh, this is good. This is a big franchise. Great.
Yeah.
But it's a day. My part in it's very small.
Yeah.
But my part in it's very small, but very important. And you know, you kind of had 20 seconds to try and get across not only Frank and Alice's love for each other, but also for Neville, and obviously what happened to them was not fabulous.
No.
Overreported. We're fine now. Alice is not fine. I'm fine. So we sort of came, you know, David explained what he wanted, and we sort of tried to find this little moment that was involved just essentially me looking back at Alice. And that's sort of what sold it.
Yeah.
So all these years later, here we are still talking about it, which is, you know, amazing.
Mm. Do you, as actors, if you have, this is like an actor question now, if you have what on the face of it appears to be a small role, a fleeting moment, do you get the importance that the fans attach to that fleeting moment? Because to the fans, having a glimpse in at this character that you've dreamed of or read about, or and you just get a snapshot, and fans attach a lot of importance. Do you get that is very important to the readership, especially of the books?
I think, I think because of the, how do I phrase this? It's a big thing. Harry Potter is a big thing, and people take it very seriously.
Yeah.
But very passionately, and it means a lot to people for various different reasons. And I think one of the things that they do very well is they're very conscious that A, it's a film, so you can't get everything into it as much as we wish we could sometimes, but there's little hints and little nods to stuff, and I think that's really important. Like, for instance, if you come and see me at my little table over in the other hall, I've got the Weasley family picture from when they went to Egypt, which is made a bit more of a deal of in the book, that, you know, they're very poor, and they win this wizard lottery and go to visit whichever brother it is that works in Egypt. But in the film, it's a fraction of a second as somebody's closing the Daily Prophet, and there's the picture there in black and white, gone, like that. But people really like that picture.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, it's when they went to... Like, it's...
Yeah.
That's really cool that we spent a day pretending, wearing fezes. And I had 40... I remember that day. I spent 45 minutes in the makeup chair being made to look sunburnt. because we're ginger, so if we went to Egypt, we would burn. We then went down to a green screen where they'd filled it with sand. Because obviously the pyramids weren't really there. This was Watford. And
it's always Watford.
We went down and we found these two random ginger dudes from the extras tent, because we didn't have a Bill or a Charlie at that point. Yeah. So we just like, you two will do, come with us. We sort of stood around, and because they filmed it, because it's a moving picture. Yeah. So we all had to kind of do this little movement on a loop for about an hour. But what was utterly ridiculous was that Warner Brothers, in their $250 million film budget that each of these films cost, or whatever, however much it was, probably more than that now, obviously we green screened in the pyramids, but they thought it would be more appropriate to bring in a live camel to fill up the background. So there's us and two random men with, this is going to sound awful, but almost literally dressing gowns and tea towels, like they were in the school nativity, playing shepherds, and a camel.
Where did the camel come from?
Oh, God knows. Never seen it again. Yeah. There are companies around the outskirts of London who you can basically ring and go, I need one of these animals, and they'll find it for you and have it trained to do something.
We had a camel on Christmas Carol. the other week.
As you were.
Like, there's a camel. Of course there is. Not even going to...
Probably the same camel.
Yeah, probably, yeah. It was quite... It was, like, pretty, like, snooty.
Yeah. It's like, I was like Harry Potter.
Similar question, then, for yourself, obviously... Mm. For you as an actor, it was a small role, it took a certain amount of time, yeah. But then the fans, again, have read the books and there's other stuff that goes on, attach that importance to that moment. Do you feel that as an actor? Do you feel that as a fan of the books and somebody who's involved in it?
I think there's, you know, there's an old saying in the old Facebook world of there's no small parts, only small actors.
Yeah.
And, you know, knowing that it meant so much to people, it means so much to people, and will no doubt continue to mean so much to people, there. You do feel a sort of a level of responsibility to not hit up. But in doing so, you've also got to sort of forget all that and,
sure.
and just play that moment, play the truth of that moment. Because that's all acting is, just being, you know, just committing to, I was saying to my friend over there, it's Maddie over there, it's just about committing to that one particular moment. And that's all it is. And if you can fake that, you've made it.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, yeah, it would have been lovely to see more of Frank and Alice in St. Mungo's. But as Chris said, you can't get everything in.
No.
And because that is the only time you ever see them, that's why it's still so important to people.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it's amazing, you know, that everybody here keeps it alive. I'm so... thrilled that I said yes the second time they asked, because it's an incredible thing to be part of. I'm still, even I've been in this business for over 20 years, and I still get a thrill because Batman.
Random Batman.
Yeah, they're all. Yeah. I still get a thrill out of it. I still love it. I still love working. I still love being involved in making movies, and. You know, seeing everybody again, and it's this kind of thing that we all have in common.
Yeah,
and I think it's wonderful. It's a beautiful thing.
It's an evergreen franchise.
Yeah.
That keeps picking up fans as the years go by. Yeah. I mean, like the first one was nearly 20 years ago, which is insane.
Yep.
Oh God. You know.
But, you know. But do you think? What was it that Joe Rowling did? That was so brilliant in the sense that it was, like you say, written for kids, but it hooked in the adults as well. So now it's picking up generational people as the years go by.
It's a good story.
Yeah.
It's a good story. It's all it is. And that's all it needs to be. You know, like, there's always been certain writers, and it's kind of probably true across various different types of writing as well. It's like, I think it's interesting because I don't think, to some extent, J.K. Rowling is the world's greatest writer.
Yeah.
But she is one of the best storytellers that there is.
Yeah.
In the same way that, say, like Roald Dahl was, or these are classic stories.
Yeah, you're not turning into classics.
Yeah, they're classics.
Yeah.
They're not the best written things in the world. They're not, you know, it doesn't matter. They're not James Joyce, they're not Shakespeare. But they are stories that you can see and you can imagine. And I think that is why they're so successful, is that... You understand what, when she's talking about Hogwarts and the staircases moving and the portraits, you see it all in your head. And I think I remember how vivid that was. And I remember when I first set foot on set going, without sounding too much like Ron, I remember just going, bloody hell, this is like, this is what it was in my head. This is exactly how I imagined the Great Hall to look in my head. And everybody else... also going, this is how I imagined it in my head. And if you've got that right, that's it. I mean, to have something that is words on a page, that you can create that kind of an image with people, that everybody is almost seeing exactly the same thing, she's a genius.
Yeah.
She really is. I mean, she's obviously, she's drawn on various stories of folklore and mythology and sort of borrowed this from that and here from there and all of that, but it's a story that...
There's a timeless story, isn't
it? Yeah, it could be any time, because it's this magical world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they don't use pens. They don't. There's a few flaws. They don't do maths. They have no preparation for any kind of real-world ability.
Where's the algebra?
I've done very well at Hogwarts in that regard.
But yeah, it could be any time. You know, yeah. Could be any time. The Weasleys drive a vintage car.
Yeah.
You know, that's all.
Yeah.
The modern world doesn't really come into it. There's no real, you know, nobody's on Facebook or Instagram. It's not going to age.
Yeah, in that exactly, sense. Yeah.
The, well, isn't it, wasn't it set in the 90s? I think the film
was
well,
yeah, set. Yeah, I mean, if you arguably, it's sort of, I think Harry starts Hogwarts in 1991 or two, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so which, because people are like, you know, Percy's 47. I'm like, no.
Hey, man, it's me, Kevin Smith, Star Wars fan, Fat the Tracks fan.
Well, your filmic experience then? You walked onto the set, you see all this stuff happening and all the sets are mind-blowing. How did you translate that? I mean, obviously, your character's there. He lives it. He knows it. It's not unusual to him.
Yeah.
So how did you kind of get out? Oh, you're an actor, obviously. It's what you do. But, you know, pretend. Getting yourself into the right
learn the lines and pretend.
Don't bump into the furniture.
Yeah, exactly. It is quite a... it's a different experience each time, I think. And I think because, like, on the earlier films, because we were very new, all of us, with the exception of maybe two or three of the kids, had never seen a film camera before, let alone acted in front of one. So Chris Columbus, who directed the first two films, and is probably the godfather of directing kids' films and yes. them being great, like Home Alone, Mrs. Doubtfire, which is my favourite film of all time, if you ever need to know that. It's amazing.
Uncle Bucky did as well, didn't he?
Uncle Bucky wrote The Goonies, he wrote various other things. Like, that's his area. Yeah. And he knows how to get an amazing performance out of a kid who's never seen the film camera before. Yeah. But to some extent we were kind of painting by numbers a little bit on the earlier ones, and it was sort of further as we got older and more experienced, we were given more of a allowance to have more of an input, I guess. But I mean, it is Stuart Craig, who's the set designer, just built these enormous sets. They are huge. And you could literally kind of disappear down a corridor, like down a corridor that you're never going to see on a film. That you know, you could turn three corners before you even saw the camera, and it'd be there. But like on the earlier films as well, less on later films, but on the earlier films, we spent a lot of time filming in places like I spent a lot of time at Gloucester Cathedral, for example, filming corridor stuff, all the stuff of Percy in the corridors in the first film. So the Troll in the Dungeon bit and the bit leading up to the common room is all Gloucester Cathedral. Right. Cloisters. So we kind of, everywhere we filmed, we were surrounded either by fake plasterboard and moulded brick sets, which looked amazing, or by cathedrals and castles and, you know, steam trains and stuff. So it was there. It was all there, and it was all as real as it could be.
And this all helped feed your imagination for you. And in any role as well, you know, it's all...
And, you know, as soon as you walk onto a Stuart Craig set, the level of detail, you don't get in television.
No.
Most films you don't get that level of detail. Every part of that set can be shot on. If you open a drawer, that's ready to be looked at, that's ready to be shot on. It's the level of detail is just incredible. And Stuart Craig does the Fantastic Beasts movies. Is stone cold genius. When we walked onto the set of Dumbledore's classroom in Fantastic Beasts 2, everybody just went wow. This is incredible, because you're there. You know, if you're trying to get into character, if you like,
it's ready made for it.
Man, you're in it.
It's immersive, isn't it? Because like normally you go onto a film set and there's, so you're in a living room. There's three walls, not four. No ceiling.
That's just been brought in.
Yeah. So, but you go into a Stuart Craig set and it's there. It's 360.
Yeah.
There's roof. You know, it's incredible.
It's all about sort of, I suppose, about layers to try and get you to where you need to be for performance. And if you're in Gloucester Cathedral or Laycock or wherever it is, I mean that all helps because you're all sort of in the right headspace. And then you know you factor in the right costume and makeup and prosthetics and all that kind of stuff. All these steps lead you to, and the work you've done prior to how you want to work this, how you want to play this, and then you put all that together and you plonk it in, and you sort of like those wind up toys, and you just go.
Yeah. Are they all aids? Are they all helps to you, or can they be overwhelming sometimes when you're in an area in the right gear? You've found the character up here. Obviously, that's what's the most important thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Can it sometimes be a bit overwhelming, or is it only ever a help?
I think it's, for me, it's only really ever, mostly only ever a help. Once you get over the kind of, because like we were saying with Stuart Craig, you open a drawer, the stuff in there, it means you don't have to double guess yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you're working with the kind of director like David Yates, like Alfonso Cuarón, who do let you kind of just go, as long as you start here and end here,
yeah,
the rest is yours.
Yeah, yeah.
You can just open a drawer and not go, if I open this drawer, is there going to be something in
here for me? Is
it going to
open?
If you kind of think this would be a really nice moment to just kind of go, I don't know, for instance, somebody's coming into your office and you're sitting there, you're having a conversation, the conversation's over. The obvious thing to do is just get on with something.
Yeah, yeah.
If you open the drawer, is there going to be a pen for you to pull out and start writing with? Or are you just kind of have to go...
Yeah.
And wait for them to shout cut. But there'll be a pen there. Playing footsie with you. Gloucester Cathedral, for instance, and this is the level of detail Stuart's team go to, is Gloucester Cathedral, because obviously we're filming in a religious building, full of beautiful stained glass windows, depicting Jesus and things and miracles and wonderful stuff happening. That doesn't happen in the Wizard World.
No.
So they sent Stuart's art department team out with a load of coloured lighting gel and a pair of scissors, and they all put little wizard's hats on baby Jesus and gowns and stuff. Because obviously it's like there's Jesus in a manger, and you know the wise men didn't look so bad because they were sort of already shining and had lights coming out from behind their heads and whatever. But they would. You know, there'd be sort of naked cherubs floating in the clouds, and they'd put little wizard ropes on them and put a wand in their hand and stuff. So he went to one of them, and that's like,
brilliant.
Yeah, it was great. I want to know how much they actually left there. I haven't been back to Gloucester since.
No, I
can imagine they must. I'm sure somebody will have.
Apparently, they're doing something with it now. That they've just spent a lot of money in Gloucester on revamping the area. So it's becoming a bit of a tourist thing.
So they've probably got rid of all the pointy hats on Jesus.
I was going to say, there's lots of areas around the country that are kind of, this part of Potter was filmed here.
Yeah.
It's Gloucester, it is like a tourist trail, isn't it?
They filmed some down here somewhere, I'm sure they did. They must have done. But yeah, there's all sorts of places.
Yeah. Yeah.
Either in the west or in the north. Yeah.
Mostly Watford, though.
Yes.
Mostly Watford.
Good old Watford. Well, speaking of Watford, have you had the good fortune to visit the set
studio
there,
tour?
The studio
yeah.
tour? What do you think of that now when you go back and look at that?
I've never been to the tour. I mean, I work at Leavesden a lot.
Right.
For Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah.
And some Marvel stuff. But I'm just waiting to be invited.
Oh, right.
If anyone wants... No?
I think I will ask.
Oh, great. Thanks.
That works.
This was easy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's really good, I have to say. It's weird. I was talking to you guys about it earlier. It's like going back to your old high school, but it's been turned into a museum about high schools. It's all the same, but it's not the same at all. It's really weird. Yeah, like the great hall. If anyone who's been, just out of interest.
Yeah.
Nearly everyone. Okay, so you go to the great. You see the great hall is there. And it's exactly the same as the Great Hall was, because it's the same set. But because it's in a different building,
right,
the ceilings are very low. And, you know, whereas we were used to this kind of dripping asbestos-ridden, hot rat-infected, or just derelict building, basically, Leavesden Studios was when we moved in there. Huge ceilings in the place, and like we would have all our sort of makeup areas and rest zones sort of down the sides of the hall. That's not there, so it's
sure.
Yeah, it's like somebody's moved your house into a museum. And it's very weird. Yeah, it's weird. It's the same, but it's just not quite the same. Like when you go back to your old house in a dream.
Yes.
But it's not quite right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a bit like that.
We've got some Potter people here.
Where?
And I did warn them that I was going to point to one of them, ask them to ask a question. Has anybody got a question?
Stitch up.
Ask your question.
How did
feel like going bad in the end of the movie?
Ooh.
That's a good one.
I don't think Percy's really bad. I think it's always fun to play bad people, though. The bad characters are always much more fun to play because you just get to be horrible every day to everybody. And there's quite a lot of fun to be had in that. But I think Percy is... he's not bad. I don't think he's really bad. I think he always wants to be good, but he gets so distracted about being good that he doesn't realise that he's actually just very good at not being very nice, and then realises that he's just not being very nice, and then, yeah, gets a bit confused along the way. He thinks that the people who are in charge are the people who are right, and that's not always the case.
Can't think of any examples of
that. No. Not at all. So there's a parallel for everything, isn't there?
Well, yeah. It's all there.
It's all there.
If you study history, then you know, then you can, you'll see what happens in the present and in the future, but you can relate it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's all circular. Mm-hmm. I see a chap at the back, yeah. Hello.
Magic. No, the actual honest the honest answer makes it sound really awful and useless, but it's still quite cool because you would think it would be some massively clever hydraulic system.
Yeah,
what it actually is a, and if you go to the studio tour you'll see the staircase, it's there. It's a staircase that has the, you know, looks like a staircase. It looks like the staircase you see. It's on bits of scaffolding with four wheels on the bottom that are all painted blue, and we filmed it on a in a big room that's all painted blue, a very specific blue, so that they can put it into a computer, remove that kind of blue and put in everything else instead. So we filmed that on a basically on a bit of scaffolding with some wheels, with four big muscly, I say muscly, four big men in what can only be described as blue morph suits, pushing the staircase. Yeah, so it's essentially like a big scaffold tower you build outside to clean the windows upstairs, and then they just push it around. It's as simple as that. I wish it was much more technical, but quite often the most magical looking things are just four men in morph suits pushing you around.
Well, it's like the doors on the Starship Enterprise, isn't it? It's two pulleys.
Yeah.
This guy's just pulling pulleys.
You know, exactly. The sound of the doors opening, that is a piece of paper coming out of an envelope.
Yeah.
Mad, isn't it? Because when you do it, you go, when you get home, try it.
Apparently lots of noises you put into films and stuff. I was listening to a No Such Thing as the Fish podcast the other day. It's great. And I kind of knew it anyway because see these things happening sometimes. But things that you would expect, like when you hear the sound of rain on an audio drama or on a radio play or whatever. I can't remember what it is now, but it's something ridiculous that is nothing like water being dripped onto a surface. It is like pebbles being thrown.
Yeah.
At stuff.
Yeah.
And the whole thing about, you know, like some chopping somebody's head off is a cabbage and a hammer.
Yeah. And if you punch somebody, it's like a cat, you punch a cabbage.
Yeah.
A broken arm is a celery.
Stick.
Because actually, the noise that chopping off someone's head makes is nothing like what you'd expect. Or it isn't a noise.
But it sounds a lot like this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
or like walking on gravel is. Yes. That sounds nothing like you'd expect walking on gravel to sound.
But it's what it's how, because we're hearing it. It's this perception.
And it's another element of the filmmaking process, isn't it?
Yeah.
That a lot of people don't think about. Or is it Foley, is it? When they add
Foley,
You know, all that additional.
It's so interesting watching Foley.
Yeah.
And it's so important because, again, it's about these layers of this composite thing that you're trying to create.
Yeah.
These, you know, from the sound to the music to the picture to the grading of the picture to the performances, all that stuff. It's, you know, you take an element away and it doesn't
work. There's this fantastic thing I saw on telly, actually. Not like I'm going to have to discover what it was, but they'd missed just a tiny little thing. It sounds like the kind of thing that would have been on Harry Hill's TV Burp a few years ago. I remember watching it, I got the Sky Room out. I was like, no, I didn't see that. And all it was somebody putting a big bag of rubbish in a wheelie bin.
Right.
But the noise they'd missed was the bag of rubbish landing in the wheelie bin. Yeah. So literally she opens the lid, the lid goes clonk as it hits the back of the wheelie bin. She drops this enormous big fat bag of rubbish in and it doesn't land anywhere, it just disappears. But yeah.
It's like Mary Poppins handbag.
But it's one of those things that you wouldn't even necessarily think about until you notice that noise isn't there. You're like, what?
Tiny
little thing.
You notice when it isn't.
And
there.
Yeah.
Starbucks.
Yeah. And like the Starbucks cup in.
Yeah.
Harry got that one very quickly. And also when present day stuff, when you watch people carrying coffee cups and they're clearly not, there's nothing in there.
Yeah.
That's, I find that quite annoying.
Yeah, because you've got the natural weight and the. Yeah.
And that nobody in any television program ever seems to actually charge their phone overnight. Who plugs their phone in next to their bed overnight? Where are the cables in TV shows? Yeah.
But no one ever finishes a drink, says thank you, or closes a door.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Or blows on Starbucks coffee as well.
True. Oh, that's true.
Because you can't just. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true.
You're getting to reality. Did the Ford Anglia actually run?
At one point Warner Brothers owned every single Ford Anglia in the UK.
Wow. Yeah.
And because, certainly every single blue one, I take that back, every single blue Ford Anglia in the UK, because they had different ones, a bit like, I don't know, stunt, like animals, you have one car that is rigged for the flying rig, you have one that can actually drive on land, only one, you have one that's designed to open the doors and fling stuff out the boot, so each car has its own specific job. A bit like, you know, we had one owl that was designed to fly, that was trained to fly with a letter in its mouth, one that was trained to sit nicely on a 10-year-old's shoulder without scalping him.
Fantatracks.
James, you mentioned you work on Fantastic Beasts.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I've known David Yates since I worked with him on Order of the Phoenix. So I also work in the film industry as something called a stand-in cast reader. So essentially they'll do the lighting and camera moves around me, and then whichever actor I'm looking after will come in and we'll let them know what's changed, and then we'll be able to shoot the scene. And my part as a cast reader is when, you know, on the second Fantastic Beasts, if we don't have Johnny because he's on the other unit doing the other stuff, then somebody has to replace him for the other actors to look at and react to. So I would do him, the scene in the auditorium. I did it over about 6 weeks, prepping all the extras for the reactions that they need to give. So every time you see the auditorium scene when we're focusing on Dan and Allison or Ezra or whoever's up there, and we're looking at them, they're looking at me, because Johnny is on the other set doing the other stuff. Because you can't, you know, because we have multiple units running at all times. And David trusts me to do that because he knows that's it within my skill set. Or at least that's what he says. And it's a fascinating job because you learn so much about the process of filmmaking, the technical way of making a movie. Yeah. But it's infinitely fascinating. And there are so few people that do it to the level that me and some of my colleagues work at.
Yeah.
But you get to be involved, you get to be party to conversations and decisions that are way above your pay grade, if you like. But it's fascinating because, you know, as with Potter, Fantastic Beasts it feels like a family. And although these movies are massive in terms of how much money they cost to make, because we shoot them over 6 or 7 months,
it's
a long time. And that's not including the reshoots and the other units that are running. That we all are very close because we work so closely together over such a long period of time. But it's just such a pleasure to be on them.
Yeah.
You know, you go to work. I go to work every day, looking forward to going to work to see how we can make it be the best it can be.
Yeah.
From every department. And you know, you form relationships with the actors that you look after. Jude is one of the ones I cover on Beasts, and I've known Jude for years because we did The Holiday many years ago, and I used to look after Robert Downey Jr. when he was here. So we did the two Sherlock Holmes with him. And then when he came in for his screen test, for we saw four people for Dumbledore.
Yeah.
But I won't tell you who they are. But one of them was Jude, and he was the first person we saw. And he came in and he nailed it.
Yeah.
And he's like most actors, he's just an ordinary bloke and has a job.
Yeah.
And knows a lot of people in the crew because he's been doing it so long. Mm. And it's just really easy to have a relationship with him. You know, I'm not there to be their friend. I'm there to make sure they know what's going on. They can be the best they can be, as we all are. But it's so easy because we all know each other. It stops being, oh my God, that's Johnny Depp. Oh my God, that's Jude Law.
Yeah.
It's just it's some work. People that you work with.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And that's the reality of it, that we all do, you know, we all breathe the same air, and all any kind of fame, whatever level it is, all it means is that more people you know who you are than you know. That's it. That's it.
And how enjoyable for you then, having been a part of Potter, and obviously this is the prequel series of films,
yeah,
getting back involved in a different way.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. On the first one, Matt Lewis, who played Neville, he came to visit, and all throughout the day he's like, James, you know your son's coming. It's like, yeah. I know. So he turned to me and said, James, what are you doing here? I said, I'm doing this. And David Heyman, one of the producers, is there, and we're all kind of having a chat.
Yeah.
And he said, so I keep trying to get the Longbottoms back in. And he's like, yeah, keep going. I'm getting back in. Yeah, it's sort of like coming home.
Yeah. We had a moment.
I mean, I think it says a lot about what an amazing place it is to work. That, because normally you go and you work on a film, it's somewhere between 3 and 9 months of your life, and then you move on and you do another job. Simple. There are people who've been working at Leaves and Studios for the Potter franchise for 20 years and haven't left. You don't get that outside of EastEnders and Corrie, really.
Yeah.
You just don't. You know, and even things like the Bond, a lot of the crew who do Bond come back and do every Bond, but they're every 3 or 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, they go off and do 4 other films in the middle. These people have been working, like Stuart, for instance. Stuart Craig has been working on a Harry Potter film, or a Wizarding World film, as we're now supposed to call them, since 1999? Realistically, probably longer than that. I don't know when David Heyman bought the rights, but you know the amount of pre-production that you do on a film is probably 2 or 3, maybe 3 years. 1998, he started working on those films.
And if you compare Leavesden then to Leavesden now,
it's the
best studio in Europe.
Yeah, it's also the most expensive studio. In I've had to try and book stages there for a couple of jobs now. Yeah. No.
Yeah, it's the, you know, if you compare it to Pinewood or Shepperton or Longcross, not a studio. Sorry.
No. I spent 6 months at Ealing, that was interesting.
Yeah, because it's so sad, but it is what it is now.
Yeah.
All that history of... Sorry.
Anyway.
We've got a couple of minutes left. I'm going to ask if anybody else has a question. There you go, there's a question there.
What was it like working with all the animals on set?
It was eventful. None of my animal stories end well.
For you or the animal?
Mostly for me, to be honest. I have a scar, which you probably won't be able to see here. I have a scar on my little finger that was caused by, you know, in the Chamber of Secrets when the owl comes flying and smashes into the window at the burrow, and then I have to go and get the letters off him, and there are Hogwarts letters. Yeah, he thought my finger was a... I don't know.
Food.
And went, I'll have that. But Gary, who was the animal handler, trainer, wrangler is the word they use, animal wrangler on the films, said, look, if he does bite you, because, you know, they're live creatures, things can happen. He said, just don't move your hand, because you'll think it's still alive and you'll try and kill it a bit more. So I was just sat there with my finger in an owl's beak going, Gary! Gary! Get him off me, thanks.
Gary's a craft at this point.
Gary was American, so Gary was often at craft having a coffee. But my other one was a bit that got cut, and I'm so gutted it got cut. So in the first film, when Percy does his big thing of taking the Gryffindors up to the Gryffindor common room, and we go into the Gryffindor common room, and we're stood there, and I say my bit, we go in through the portrait, and we're stood there, and I say something like, the girls' dormitories are here and the boys' dormitories are here, and then the scene ends, I think, in the film, pretty much. But in the script and what we filmed, because obviously you film loads of stuff and then stuff gets kind of cut down, the scene ended with me saying, boys' dormitories are here and the girls' are here, all your stuff's there. Has anybody got any questions? At which point Neville Longbottom puts his hand up and says, has anybody seen my toad? Trevor the toad. And I put my hand into my robe pocket and pull out Trevor the toad, who is about this big. And really ugly and horrible, and not my thing. Give me cute and fluffy, don't give me slimy and webbed. No, not cool. I can't remember what type of, I keep telling people it was a cane toad, and I was watching something the other day, and apparently cane toads are insanely poisonous, yeah. So it wasn't one of those. But it was an Amazonian something, it was about yay big. Which is big enough. Yeah, but because of the way we were filming this scene, we were doing it in one long take. So I walk into the portrait, sweep around to the front, do my whole spiel, blah, blah, blah. So I had this thing in my pocket for like 5 minutes, and it's alive. It's a live thing, which had to be inserted in at the right angle and the right direction so that I could just pop my hand in, scoop it up, pull it out smoothly, of course, not quite like, and then hold it up like that, sort of at head height so the camera could see it and go, this is Trevor. But the problem with toads, if anybody's ever met a toad, is that their natural defence mechanism is to wee.
Smells lovely. Nice.
That took 3 days to film that scene. I got weed on every single take.
By why they cut it.
That's probably why they cut it, is me just looking utterly horrified. And a little bit green. Yeah, so but the reason they cut it, I'm sorry, finish the story, Chris. The reason they cut it was because, and it was there for quite a long time, but then they do these things called test screenings in the States where they basically show it to an audience of people who don't know what film they're going to see. They all have to sign things saying, we promise we won't tell anybody. But they essentially review the film and go, this worked, this didn't work, I didn't understand that, I didn't like this. And then they kind of edit it so that it's going to please everyone. And they showed it to a load of people in America who didn't understand Matt Lewis, who plays Neville Longbottom's very Yorkshire accent, because he does have a proper Leeds accent. And in a Leeds accent, when you say, has anybody seen my toad, it comes off as, has anyone seen my turd? And the Americans didn't think that looking at people's turd was appropriate, so... yeah. That's where that one went.
There are certain words that don't cross the chin.
Yeah. And unfortunately, he was saying toad, but just with such a... Has anyone seen my turd?
I don't think
not
we can
great.
Top that. I don't think we can top that.
Not great.
No. Definitely not. Guys, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It's
thank
been
you
great
having us.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That's all for this special episode of Making Tracks. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Android, Spotify, SoundCloud, TuneIn, iHeartRadio and Spreaker. If you want to find Fanta Tracks out there in the wild, you can find us on smart speakers such as Amazon, Alexa, Apple HomePod, Google Home and Sonos. We're also available in your car with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, on gaming consoles and television. You can find us on Fanta Tracks TV, on YouTube or the Fanta Tracks app. And of course, you can drop onto the dedicated landing page for Fanta Tracks Radio on fantatracks.com. We'll be back very soon, but for now, clear skies.